David Frank Gomez, thanks for coming on the show today. How's it going?
Yeah, it's going good. I'm glad to be here.
Good. I'm excited to have you. You're a mindfulness and life coach and a mentor, and you know, you basically just help people figure out what's going on in their worlds and their lives and how to make improvements or adjustments or find meaning and purpose. And it's a very noble mission that you're on. And as I've seen and on your website, you've helped a tremendous amount of people in incredible ways. And so I'm excited to talk to you today about, you know, your process and how you incorporate mindfulness into your coaching practice and, you know, what that sort of means for just everyday people listening about why mindfulness is important and why, you know, in our modern world, it's what's kind of needed. And so, yeah, I'm excited for this conversation. So how about we sort of start off with a general question about you? Like, how did you get into mindfulness and sort of what drew you in about it?
Well, you know, when I was a young man, 26 in my early 20s, I came to my spiritual path. I, you know, came to my teacher. And so I've been sort of traveling this sort of this path of mindfulness and finding meaning and purpose in life sort of from a very early age. So I've always been interested in these kind of things. And, you know, in a sense, what we're trying to do, all of us, is to find a way to live skillfully and navigate through the endless ups and downs of what it's like to be a human body in time and space.
Yeah.
So it's something I've been thinking about, reading, talking to people about for a long time. And, you know, long before I was a coach, I mean, I was mentoring people because I had this practice. And so people just naturally came to me and they wanted to have conversations. They wanted to talk about things, deep things that were in their hearts. They might not have been religious people or even understood any of that, but they had a need to want to discuss the meaning of life. Mm-hmm. And so I've been having these conversations with people for many, many years. And then much later in life, I became a coach at middle age. I made a sort of a radical transformation in my life. You know, I took all these years of practice and ideas and I formulated them into a system.
Right.
So that's kind of how I came to this path.
And what do you think it was about, you know, that your initial contact with your teacher that drew you in? Like, what exactly were you looking for or hoping to find or achieve, you know, with a sort of spiritual practice?
Well, I think it's probably the same reason a lot of people come to a spiritual path is because in spite of their success and their experiences, it feels like something is missing. Mm-hmm. And so I follow a wisdom path that's of, you know, in the Eastern traditions. And what I appreciated was that my teacher made the spiritual life appealing. Mm-hmm. It's not like some old man with a beard, you know, in some far off cosmos in heaven, you know, judging us. No, it was much different. It was this idea that you can find a portable paradise within yourself. You can create the circumstances within yourself mm-hmm. for happiness and peace and joy. So it was very approachable and it involved, you know, a step-by-step approach. The foundation, of course, being meditation, being some kind of stillness mm-hmm. practice. And so that was very appealing to me because even at a young age, I had realized that there was more going on to this world than met the eye. And I was a hairdresser at the time, so I was meeting a lot of very interesting people. I was meeting wealthy people and famous people. And, you know, I'd studied at the best school in the world and I was working at one of the best salons in Canada. So I had this opportunity to peer into the lives of people. Hmm. And I saw that no matter what their external circumstances were, they all kind of suffered the same things, right?
Right.
You know, and so that became kind of the focus of my life, and I've been pursuing it ever since in my own way, stumbling towards happiness, as they say.
Yeah, and it's true. I mean, I've had a similar sort of experience to that of, you know, being young and sort of seeing the world as something that, you know, you tend to look to fulfill you and give you happiness and meaning, and that doesn't really work out, and that has to come from within, right? You kind of have to find that peace within yourself, and then things in the outside world kind of fall into place a lot easier, right? And that the sort of satisfaction that one gets from, you know, so-called material stuff, whether it's wealth or people or places or things, like, it's kind of not at the same level as a deep peace that you find in meditation, right? And then the sort of skill of a spiritual practice, at least in my experience, is to be able to take that stillness out into the world while doing things, right? Not just while meditating, because it's all well and good to be able to do it while you're meditating for a few minutes or a few hours a day, but really, if the rest of your life is still chaos and upsetting and, you know, emotional and unbalanced, then that doesn't exactly line up. But it's when you can sort of take that skill and take it across the life experience that's where it sort of becomes a lot more integrated into my life, right? Mm-hmm. And I think and it's a very interesting phenomenon, right? The stillness, because you kind of expect that to be fulfilled, there has to be something that fulfills you, right? Mm-hmm. And the kind of opposite tends to be true, right? Where really that peace and fulfillment comes from this place of nothingness, so to speak, or stillness. And it's just very, in some sense, counterintuitive, but experientially exactly right. Right.
Yes.
Has that been your experience as well?
Yeah, it's an embodied practice, and it's interesting mm-hmm. what you said. There's a word called sukha. It means non-energetic joy. So it's a joy that doesn't come from expending energy. So, and I'm not, you know, I'm a coach, so obviously I'm in the business of helping people achieve their cherished goals. So yeah. I'm not knocking external goals
not. And yeah.
achievement. But I think if you look closely, and mindfulness is an awareness practice, you have to start asking yourself, where does happiness come from? How can I cultivate it? Mm-hmm. How can I have more of it? And you start to realize that no matter what you seek out there, it's never enough. And whatever is out there has a beginning, a middle, and an ending. And so, yeah, I think as you cultivate this stillness practice, you start to realize that it's coming out of you, that it's something that you can nourish. And, you know, that's an exciting moment, especially in today's world, mm-hmm. Where, you know, we're bombarded by information, and the majority of it is not particularly helpful. It doesn't make you happier, more peaceful, more joyful. So in a sense, what I do is I take the best ideas I can find and I curate them for people. So I cut through all the noise for people, and I have a system, an ecosystem, mm-hmm. and I only use techniques that I know work. And so you know, otherwise, let's face it, most people are consumers. They're just like, what's the next self-help book to read? What's the next TED Talk to watch? What's the next free ebook to download? Mm-hmm. It's exhausting. So, you know, when you're ready to stop looking and start finding, you know, then you're starting to get somewhere.
So in your experience, like with your clients and or in general with helping people, like, what is it that helps people have that sort of perspective shift, if you know what I mean?
I mean, it's a difficult question. It's a good question, difficult to answer because it's so different for everybody, but there's
Right.
probably a few keys. One is having kind of long-term support, right? Like anybody can go and read a self-help book, buy an online course. The truth is most people don't finish the books, they don't finish the courses, they watch the TED Talk, but it doesn't make any appreciable difference in their life. So one is you have someone to journey with you over a longer period of time. The second is accountability, because you're going deeply into your life and you're having an accountability partner. You have a witness. You have somebody that is witnessing the things you say you want and asking you if you're not doing them. Having a cheerleader, having a supporter, having an inspirer, having someone to present ideas, create a framework for you, a step-by-step process. So, in one sense, it's just easier and more enjoyable, I think, working with a coach. And most people who work with coaches really appreciate the journey. It's not just about getting stuff done. It's not just about getting somewhere. It's about who am I becoming in the process. And so I think it's very beneficial. I think everyone should have a coach, not all the time, but for periods in their lives. Like occasionally you need a nudge, you need some inspiration, you need a fresh perspective, you need a bit more accountability, you need a little coaching. And you know, there's a reason Olympic athletes who win gold because they have coaches. There's a reason CEOs have coaches, high-performing professionals. The process works. You just have to find the right fit. You have to find the right coach for you.
And the relationship with a coach is very interesting. Similar to like, a sort of a therapy role, but it's more, I guess, practical and oriented toward not like resolving trauma and things like that. It's more about facilitating a more, effective life in some sense, right? And but aside from the comparison to sort of therapy, it's like what I found helpful having a coach at some points is, what it does is it gives someone that's outside of anyone who you're necessarily worried about affecting with problems or ideas or things like that, where if you have a spouse or a partner or say, and then you kind of there might be certain things that you feel like engaging with them with would be not as easy as it would with a sort of neutral third party who is kind of just in there for your best interest, and there's no counter forces that might come up as a result of certain conversations or ideas. And it's a tremendous thing for people to experience, especially when they need it, right? They say like when the student is ready, the teacher appears. It's like that those are the times when people, I guess, start coaching is when they realize that like this is a time where they need someone to walk with them, right? And to guide them along their journey.
Yeah, it's a very good point. A neutral third party. We all need help outside of our close personal relationships, right? So, you know, your wife or your husband or your partner, they don't make the best coach, your business partner, your friends, because they all have a kind of a, there's something they want. They want a certain thing from you. And oftentimes our environment wants us to sort of be, to show up in a certain way. So coaching is like an incubation space. It's a time and space where you can come and you can incubate your best self without the pressures, the timelines, the inputs, the advice, you know, because coaching isn't about giving people advice. It's about helping people access their own deep inner wisdom. And then you go back into the world, kind of like what you said about meditation. You go back into the world with this new knowledge, this new perspective. It's like a booster shot, really, I think. And, you know, and as you said about the sitting meditation, like the sitting practice supports the external world. So what we're trying to do is find this empowering balance between sort of our inner life, our values, what we care deeply about, and then our external life. How do we want to put those values to work in the world? What would we like to achieve? but also how do we want to achieve success? How do we want the journey to feel?
Right. What does it look like?
Yeah, and also learning to enjoy the process, learning to enjoy the step-by-step process to get where you're going. So I'm a process thinker. I'm less interested in outcomes. I'm more interested in how can we make the process enjoyable so that when you get to the outcome, you can enjoy it because you've been enjoying the steps to get there.
Right. And even if the outcome isn't what you thought it was going to be, you've enjoyed the journey and the process along the way. And so that's great news, right? And since everything's a continually evolving process and, you know, change is constant and whatever it is, if you can figure out a way to enjoy the journey along the way, then you're enjoying everything, right? You don't have to suffer through to get that one bit of goodness at the end, right?
Yeah, yeah, well put. And I think that's why if you look closely, you'll see that in one sense, goals are quite disempowering for people because a goal is an outcome. It's something you don't have and there's a gap. And so, you know, I even noticed this over and over in my coaching, like people reach a goal, like some cherished goals, and then they step over it. They're already rushing to the next one. And so we live in an outcome-based world. Everything's some finish line. We're continually trying to get to some finish line. Oh, and then I can... And so mindfulness is a much different approach. I'd say it's a much more effective approach if you're interested in enjoying quality and depth of life.
Right. So that's how it like integrates with the coaching, right? Is traditional coaching is very much, I mean, I guess this is more of a question. Is traditional coaching much more along the lines of goal setting and achievement and how to reach those goals? And then the incorporation of a mindfulness practice is adding the focus to also be on the sort of moment-to-moment experience of it.
Yeah, I have fused the two together. Coaching on its own is, it's effective, but it's unfulfilling. You need something else. And so you need to build a solid inner life, and then you need to go out into the world and decide what you want to experience. So the two of them together create this powerful fusion. You know, when I first started coaching, I wasn't satisfied with coaching. It wasn't enough for me. I realized it's not effective enough. You know, so what? You achieve a bunch of stuff. You know, I wasn't interested in working with people who just wanted more stuff. I was interested in working with people who wanted to build an impactful, significant, joyful life and also get stuff done. So I was like, well, I need to integrate everything I've learned from my practice and create a new way of coaching. So yeah, I think it's highly effective because you need both your inner and your outer.
So
that's kind of the framework.
No, and that makes a lot of sense, right? And I think it's a very good model for, you know, sort of a coaching practice where it's not just about that. I mean, it's about the whole package, right? And so in terms of the like mindfulness side of things, right, what are some of the ways that you kind of help people to start being more mindful? Or how do you even present mindfulness to someone who's, let's say, maybe heard of it, but has never tried it or doesn't really know what it means, right?
I have a big textbook. It's about 10,000 pages long.
Right.
And I make them read it. No, mindfulness is a basket of practices. So my work is based on one mantra: everything is perfect as it is. That's mindfulness. And there's plenty of room for improvement. That's coaching. So mindfulness is just, the definition I use is it's a way, it's a practice of becoming friendlier with the way things are. And from this place of more friendliness, you can step off in a more empowered way. So we introduce the practice, you know, in the work that I do in many ways. In some senses, it's quite ordinary because we're taking what's happening in daily life and we're dissecting it from a mindful approach. along with that, I'm teaching some of these other baskets of practices. So I teach meditation practices. Mindfulness is taking mindful breaks out of your day. It's taking pauses to check in with yourself. Mindful breathing practices. There's also a philosophical component to it, the idea of change and impermanence. Mm-hmm. Everything is changing. Everything is impermanent. So I weave these practices into daily life. So it's not, mindfulness is not separate. It's not something you need more time for. It's something that you weave into your daily life. And so that's how I teach it, mm-hmm. because it's most effective that way.
Right. And right? So I'm interested in that first point that you made, that everything is perfect as it is, right? Because I think that that's a central foundation of it for me, right? Just talking from my own experience of, like, you know, when you're in any situation in life, there seems to be, if you kind of take a step back from your immediate response and emotional feelings about the situation, even your logical and rational thoughts, you can entertain other ways of seeing it, right? And eventually, if you kind of, like, give yourself the space to kind of look at a bunch of different options of how this situation might be perceived, you kind of realize, like, oh, there's an, like, almost an infinite number of ways to perceive it, right? And I mean, I know this is on the more philosophical side of things, but when you
I love it.
Yeah, but so for me, like, when you kind of look at it in that way, it's much easier to kind of get the sense of, like, well, the universe has seemingly orchestrated this moment to be exactly as it is, right? The entire history of the universe happened in exactly the way that it did, such that this moment right now is the way it is, right? And then for us to sort of take a human mind and be like, oh, it's wrong, or it's insufficient, or it's bad, or it's not enough, that's kind of our limited way of perceiving things, right? This is just how I sort of have come to see things. And I haven't always seen it that way. And I'm not saying everyone has to see it this way, or that it's absolute or anything like that. But, you know, in my experience of it, it's like, if you can see this moment as being perfect as it is, even if it's unpleasant or uncomfortable, or there are things that you don't like about it, you know, having that acceptance allows for at least, you know, some level of peace with the acceptance, right? Because you're not fighting against reality, right? You might want to take steps to change things, and that's okay, but fighting against the reality of the moment seems to be very irrational, right?
That's my experience too. You know, there's a saying, how do you know something was supposed to happen to you? Because mm-hmm. it did.
Right.
So I don't practice mindfulness because I'm a spiritual guru. I practice because it hurts to argue with reality.
Mm-hmm.
So if people want to argue with reality, go for it. I'm not opposed to it. You know, I have just found a much more effective way. And it doesn't mean mindfulness it's not a passive exercise. It takes a lot of courage to practice everything as perfect as it is.
Mm-hmm.
And there's room for improvement. It's a paradox.
Yeah.
A great mantra is, whatever arises, love that. So you're trying to get into the practice of using the mind to transcend your environment. And how do you do that? In a moment where things are going, whoa, sideways, you bring yourself back to your mind and you say your mantra. Okay, whatever arises, love that. I'm going to see, like, what's good about this experience that I don't understand yet?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a practice. It's counterintuitive. It's not what we're taught. We're taught that, like, a happy, successful life is a perfect life with no problems. But in my experience, my problems, my troubles, my challenges, this is what has allowed me to become who I am.
Yeah. And that sort of contrast that exists in the world is almost necessary, right? And you can't have darkness without, I mean, you can't have light without darkness. You can't have hot without cold. you can't have happiness without unhappiness, right? And it's a weirdly unpleasant reality to kind of have to come to terms with that, right?
Because it's not how people see it. Yeah, and you know, there's a word, equanimity, right? It basically means evenness of mind, you could say. And so in the wisdom traditions, like even-mindedness is a deep and foundational practice.
Right.
So, you know, success or failure, honor or dishonor, praise or blame, gain or loss, they're the same to an accomplished mindfulness practitioner. It doesn't mean that one doesn't feel worse than the other, but you stop, nothing gets quite as hot. And so from that perspective, you can navigate through it much more effectively because you realize there's something else going on. And that's a process. You know, I think part of the problem in our modern society is A, too much information, complete overwhelm, and speed. Everybody wants things fast. So my work is slow, rich, and deep. And if you're not patient, then you wouldn't want to work with me, because if you want something valuable in your life, then take your time and do it right.
Yeah.
Figure it out.
Nothing worthwhile comes quick. There's an expression that goes something like that, right?
Yeah, and they call them cliches because cliches are true, generally speaking, right?
Yeah.
And I do think it's important in your life to have voices, to have teachers, to have guides, to have mentors, and to step out of this endless chaos. I mean, the world is the world. It's chaos. It's always been chaos. We've had pandemics. There's nothing particularly new there. We've had world wars. We still have war. We still have, you know, famine and many things we haven't solved. And you have to ask yourself, well, what's going on here? You know, and I think it's because humanity refuses to sort of go inside and then figure some of this stuff out. So that's always been something that's interested me. And I think if you want to improve the world, just do the good that's in front of you. Just start with yourself.
Yeah. I mean, it's always, you know, seemed that way to me as well. And it's like, why do you think it is that, you know, our modern society doesn't like to reflect inwards? Like, where do you see that coming from?
Well, you know, without getting too philosophical, you know, in the wisdom tradition that I'm part of, we sort of see the world as a school. And, you know, you could say it's like a teaching, it's like a university, and everyone's in a different grade. So evolution happens not only, you know, in a massive way, it happens individually. So listen, you're born in a mystery, you die, you leave this world, and you go to some mysterious place you don't know. And then you have this period in between, this beautiful period, but you don't know when you're getting off the roller coaster ride.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if that doesn't make you at least want to inquire a little bit into the meaning of life, then you're sort of stuck with life. And so I think perhaps everyone's just in a different phase in their evolution. You know, I don't have a good answer for it, but yeah. I think as long as we're focused outside, in a finite world, a world of duality, where everything has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And yet we kind of pretend like we live here. You know, we don't live here. We're renters.
Yeah.
We're renting this space, right? We're temporary visitors. And nobody gets out alive. So that sent me on a quest because I wanted to try and understand at a deeper level. And I think, you know, that's just, you know,
a
process of evolution, I suppose. I don't know. That not a great answer, but I'm not sure. I don't have an answer for it.
No, that was a good answer. I think, you know, you're on to the right sort of line of thinking there, you know, in my opinion. I think it's like, especially these days where, you know, religion has, for better or worse, become in Western societies much less significant and influential in people's lives, right? And I'm not making a judgment call on that, but I think that one of the consequences of that happening is that there is that lack of meaning in people's lives, because they're now open to answers. They aren't just like accepting that whatever their religion's version of the meaning of life is, right? Because to a large degree, people have now sort of seen religion more as like just different groups, right, that you happen to be born into or not. And, you know, I mean, there's good and bad that comes from religion, just like everything. And I think foundationally, religion aims to be the same sort of thing as any sort of spiritual practice. And maybe it's been too institutionalized and whatever. It's not the topic of the conversation. But I think that the decrease in influence of religion in our culture today has left this, you know, this like gap of meaning in people's lives, and a space has arisen for something like mindfulness to come in and provide a few of those answers, right? Where it doesn't come with a whole, you know, background of study and theology and, you know, rules and disciplines and all that kind of stuff that religion has sort of become these days. It's much more of a practice of like the essence of religion, you could say, which is that connection with something that is deep within you and, you know, ever outside of you as well. And so I think that sort of like spiritual famine, as it's been called, is kind of partly the reason why we're seeing such a huge uptake in mindfulness and spiritual practices in the Western world as well. And it's interesting that a lot of it, or most of it, you could say, has come from Eastern traditions, right? And I guess it's because people are looking for something different. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you raise an interesting point. I think it's there is a vacuum, I think, you know, and suffering creates the vacuum, because eventually people, they suffer enough that they start to ask the bigger questions. So
suffer enough and
I'm
go,
part of a
what
mystical
the fuck is going on.
yeah, exactly. And so I'm part of a what I would call a mystical tradition, in the sense that we're deeply rooted in meditation and embodied practice, mm-hmm. right? So when you get into the mystical side, all religions are the same. There's a mystical side to Christianity. There's a mystical side to Hinduism. Mm-hmm. And so you're right. Ordinary religion has become kind of about like my book, my teacher, my rules. It's become kind of a rule book. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the mystical traditions, you're trying to have the experience of love, the experience of divine love, of peace, of wisdom, and not the intellectual understanding of it. So I think religion has been, you know, co-opted in a sense. Mm-hmm. And but there is a hunger and a craving. What's good about mindfulness, and the reason that, you know, I use it, is because it isn't a religion. Mm-hmm. You don't have to believe anything to practice it. You don't have to believe in God. You can, if you like. You could actually make mindfulness your religion if you want, or you could just be a completely secular person and practice it. Mm-hmm. So it has a lot of benefits. It is a spiritual technology, because if you can't be where you are, then where are you?
Yeah.
Your body's here. Where is your mind? And for most people, it's pretty obvious where their mind is. It's in the future, worrying about something that hasn't happened, which is a fantasy. Or it's in ancient history, it's in a memory. Mm-hmm. And most people spend the majority of their lives in a memory or a fantasy. And that leads to deep unhappiness.
Yeah, especially if those versions aren't pleasant, right?
Well, they never are, yeah. You know, because the fantasy rarely is the fantasy like, oh, it's going to be amazing. And even if it is, it's still something you don't have. The fantasy is usually gulp, what's going to happen? And the memory is like, oh, I wish I had done it differently. It's often tinged with regret.
Yeah.
So I'm not suggesting we can't use memory in a beautiful way, or that we can't use the future as a way of designing things, you know?
Of course,
so
yeah.
There's an aspect of our mind that is highly effective for dealing with the future. It's called the narrative network. It's the storytelling network. Mm-hmm. It's what you do when you daydream, when you're, you know, just off thinking about the future and planning for your future. It's wonderful. The problem is people can't turn it off.
Yeah.
So they spend their whole lives, it's like the game show in their head, right?
Yeah, you get
And
stuck there.
you get stuck there. And so, in my work, I'm teaching people how to use it effectively. Like, use it when you need it. And when you don't need it, hit the off button.
Right. And that off button is mindfulness, right? Becoming mindful, essentially.
It's becoming mindful, going to the breath, learning how to meditate. Just taking a moment. We could take a mindful moment right now where we could just check in with ourselves and just
Yeah.
take a breath and just sort of experience the miracle of you and I talking together.
Yeah. Across the
It's
country.
miraculous
Yeah.
across the country,
Instantly.
with this incredible technology,
Yeah.
because I have an analog brain. I'm old enough that, I grew up before the internet, before cell phones, back in the day. I was the channel changer when my dad said, "Okay, change the channel." There were only six.
Right.
I was the guy that changed the channel.
Yeah.
So, and also having this philosophical approach that everything's changing and everything's impermanent. So don't put all your eggs in that basket, right?
Right, and it's true, and it's not hard to have one of those moments. You just have to kind of allow yourself to do it and also practice it, because if it's not a default mode for you, so to speak, and it doesn't come easy, then it's often can be quite a challenge. But like anything, you just practice it a few times, and the more you do it, the better you get at it, and the more frequently you'll find yourself doing it just by default. You don't even have to think about it at some point, right? It becomes almost like a muscle memory, although it's not exactly that. It's like a, I don't know how you would phrase that, a mindful muscle memory or something. But it's amazing what it does, right, to you and to your experience of life, to not have to feel trapped all the time.
It's you brought up a good point because I would say mindfulness is 99% practice and 1% theory. And all the great wisdom teachers say the same thing. Like, you have to get it in your bones. You have to get it in your marrow. And the first stage is you have to learn about it. It's in your brain. It's intellectual, right? And you practice. It's like forgetting, 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 remembering, forgetting, remembering. That's the initial stage of the practice. Then you start to get it in your bones a little bit. And then it's like remembering, 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 forgetting. Until it becomes so embodied in you. And even then, I'm not perfectly mindful every second of the day. I'm just a human like everybody else. The difference is I have a different relationship to this stuff. Like I don't take it quite as seriously, perhaps. And so there's a spaciousness that starts to develop when you practice mindfulness. Your world gets bigger.
And that 1% that you mentioned that was sort of the theory of it is not anything. I mean, it's something that everyone can understand, right? It's just so basic of just like being present in the moment. I mean,
Well, give me 5 weeks and I can teach anyone mindfulness. When I teach mindfulness, I do it over 5 weeks and I go through the basics, I go through acceptance, I go through judgment, I go through compassion. These are the three. I focus on a few high-level areas that are really the meat and potatoes of the practice. It's all you need to know.
And then it's just practice.
But the theory is important. The theory is important. It does root you in the practice.
Yeah, because we are, like very thinky kind of creatures. We need to understand or think about it in order to really implement it. At least that's how we think things need to go.
And there's an aspect of wisdom that is valuable. Jhana yoga, it's the yoga of wisdom. It's the yoga of the intellect. It's the yoga of thinking. But it takes a giant of intellect to understand the world from that perspective. There are much easier ways, and I've always been interested in a more effective, easier way. So I don't have the brain power for that. So
Yeah, I'm not sure anyone does.
Very, very few people do. And you can get really caught up in your head. And what I notice is that we live in a mind-dominated world. So it's almost like you look around. If you could see the world the way it really is, you'd see like most humans have giant heads and little tiny hearts
Right.
because they're in there all the time.
Like those sort of stereotypical alien cartoons of like really tiny bodies and thin and, like no mass and then a giant head with a giant brain. It's true.
And the brain is a wonderful tool, but it's as they say, the mind is supposed to be a servant, not the master. And so when you can't control it and you're ruminating and you're overthinking and you're in the future or the past, like it's very anxiety producing. And so there's a way out of that. There's a way out of that, and it's not new, and it's not shiny. This is what drives me crazy about the modern world, is all the sort of the marketing lies and this endless need for people to, like, what's new?
Upgrades.
There's nothing new. I don't teach anything new. My stuff's old and dusty, but it works.
Yeah, it's been around arguably since the beginning of time, if you want to look that deeply into it. At least since the beginning of humankind. Right.
The ancient rishis were figuring this stuff out. Like the practices that I practice, I mean, they're over 3,500 years old. Like this is not new stuff. And this is part of the problem in the information age. Because the ideology of cancer is that it's endless growth. That's what a cancer cell does. It just grows and grows and grows until it kills the organism. Look around at the world. This is what we're seeing. It's endless growth. And so, in my work, what I'm trying to get to is this idea of sufficiency. And sufficiency isn't an amount of something, it's this exquisite idea that you're enough, that you have enough, the world is enough. Enoughness is inside of you. And when people figure that out, oh, what a sigh of relief.
Right, because they take all the it takes all the pressure off them to solve all the world's problems. Right? Never mind you just your own problems. But it's true, and we do see this massive influx of, information into our lives. I mean, these days with our technology, we prob in a few years we probably process more information than our ancestors did in their entire lives. Right? And we have more knowledge, for what it's worth, than most of human history, each of us, right? Like most of human history, how much could they possibly know? They could know about their area, their people, their history, that kind of stuff, right? Basic local politics, maybe. Maybe some stuff about other cultures and other peoples and other places, and maybe their religion and stuff like that. But really, the kind of broad knowledge that we have today, just sort of as standard, is, I mean, it's overwhelming, is the right way to phrase it, I think. It's just too much. I mean, you go in the news and you can learn about 1,000 different terrible things that are happening all over the world that you have absolutely nothing to do with, nor could you have any sort of solution for it, right? I mean, maybe you could choose one or two to make a real impact with, but really what that does is it just kind of facilitates this, draw of information, of energy, that everything's terrible everywhere, right? And that doesn't help, right? And why do you need to know all those things? Do you? I mean, the weird part is it kind of feels like you should know it. That's the other paradox of it, is it's there's some sense of enjoyment of, like, not enjoyment, but of satisfaction of, like, learning about all the troubles, because then you're kind of like, oh, well, at least I know what's happening, right? But really, do you need to know what's happening in 189 countries in the world? Like, what's the political situation there? Like, does that help you as a sort of regular person? You know what I mean? I just think it's so much information.
And I think, there's just a lot of kind of ideas out in the material world that aren't as true as we think they are. And one of them is this idea, knowledge is power. Not really. Knowledge isn't power. There's a lot of knowledge out there. I mean, as you said, like theoretically, we have access to all the knowledge we could want. So we should have a world that's peaceful. We should have solved the idea of war. There should be no famine. There should be no social injustice. I mean, we know all this stuff. So knowledge isn't power. Wisdom is power.
Mm-hmm.
And wisdom comes from some embodied sense of understanding, like what is the kind of knowledge I need? And unfortunately, as consumers, because there's only two things you can do, you can either consume things or you can create things.
Yeah.
And so we have to consume some things, but really what we're trying to do is become creators. But now with Google, there's no deep research. People are just, everyone's an expert on everything.
Right? Oh, yeah.
Like just go online, like find a mindfulness practice, practice it for like 2 seconds. Ah, that doesn't work. I'll go back online. What's better? Oh yeah, here's a new guy saying, ah, forget mindfulness, like do this instead.
Yeah.
So you're literally rewiring your brain to be a surface searcher. You're surfing the surface. And what do you get on the surface? You get turmoil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so again, slow, rich, and deep. Like if you go beneath the surface, that's where you find the real stuff you're looking for. And so we're in a surface society where people are convinced that there's some secret they don't know about. And if they could just, the next ebook will, you know, the next expert will tell them.
Yeah.
So my work is the complete antithesis of that. I'm not interested in that.
Right. There's no secret solution.
I'm interested. There's no secret solution. There's no three-step process. There's no like easy as pie. Some of it's easy. I mean, mindfulness is pretty easy. Sometimes people can make incredible results happen quite quickly. Some things take more time, but I'm not interested in the easy promises of regular sort of folks who are just, you know, marketers trying to disguise things. Because mindfulness is a sacred practice and it's available to everybody. It's free.
Yeah.
It's available to everybody and anyone can get good at it.
Yeah. And hopefully more people do, right? And I think that more people are. I mean, you're seeing it, you know, make its way through our society, as we said, like it's sort of infiltrating all areas. I mean, even if you go to the sort of corporate world and you see that there's all kinds of, you know, seminars and things like that that are happening, and like lunch and learns or whatever, however they sort of educate their sort of, you know, employees. And a huge part of it is mindfulness these days. And there's like mindfulness exercising, there's mindfulness reading, there's mindfulness news consumption. You know, they're kind of trying to introduce it into all aspects of life, which I think is a great approach. I mean, I don't know if it will work necessarily because it's not exactly something you can kind of force on people. People kind of need to come to it themselves, but at least it's out there, right? And making some traction. Has that been your experience as well, that it's become a lot more popular? Or do you think it's become too like pop culture-y?
Well, I think that always happens with everything. You know, people have accused me of jumping on the mindfulness bandwagon, which I don't understand, right? It's not, I don't really look at it that way. I think there are people that are superficially always looking for the next thing, and mindfulness is the next thing until it's not. So I just practice. I just go on and on with my practice. You know, I try and, you know, people who are interested in this stuff, they come into my realm. I work with them. I do that kind of stuff too, organizational work. I teach it. You know, the harvest is plenty.
Yeah.
The students are few, right? So I don't know. I'm always interested in people that want to sort of understand it and not just use it as some crutch, you know, because that's how mindfulness is marketed now. Like, you'll sleep better, you'll lose weight, you'll be smarter, you'll be nicer, people will like you more, you'll be more successful,
yeah,
you'll make more money. You know, all true in one sense, but that's not why I practice.
Right.
You practice because you're looking to create happiness and contentment and meaning inside yourself, which means you have to become friendly with the world that you're in, with yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all over the map. It's everywhere. But as far as I'm concerned, anytime somebody is talking about a really good idea, I'm into it.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it's better that it's happening rather than not, right? Because
For sure.
People might start off with the wrong kind of idea about what it is, but do some a little investigation and find out they're like, oh, I want to be on this train, right? And yeah, it's weird when people are like, you're jumping on the mindfulness bandwagon, because really standing on it, you'd be like, yeah, come on. Like, this is where it's at.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
What are you complaining
this
about?
This is a good bandwagon.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, and you know, a lot of these are just, they're tropes. They're the stuff that's going on out there. So I think wise people are trying to develop, insight.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to develop insight. And then from that insight, you take effective action out in the world. And so if you are just taking action out in the world, but you have no insight, you're kind of living on autopilot, right? You're just another busy person. If you have a whole bunch of insight, but you don't take action, you're just a lazy person who's not putting your wisdom to work in the world. You're not using your gifts.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something there to be explored. So in everything, I'm trying to bring this balance between this idea of mindfulness and this idea of coaching and action, right? So when we put them together, we can not only be highly effective in the outer world and do the things we want, have the things we want, experience the things we want, we can also do it in a peaceful, kind, compassionate, loving way. And, you know, that's my jam. That's what I'm into.
Yeah, and that's how the world transforms, you know. You want someone, if you're someone who wants to transform the world, you know, they say you sort of start with yourself and the world will transform from it, because your influence extends outwards, right? It's very hard to force it from the outside in. Well, it's probably impossible to do it that way. And it's great.
It doesn't work.
Yeah, and I think that we certainly need a lot more of the kindness and compassion and joy in the world, you know, these days with everything that's going on. And not that that kind of stuff will stop happening, just that it's okay for us to also look at what are the good things that are also happening, you know, in that balance, and trying to find that place of alignment to live a much more sort of fulfilled life, right?
Yeah, and you know, the analogy that I like is one that my teacher used is, you know, you've got these two diamonds. They're both identical. One's covered in mud. One isn't.
Mm-hmm.
So one reflects the light and one doesn't. But they're still diamonds. They're both there being the same thing. So in a sense, our lives are just, we're just trying to wash the mud off ourselves so that we can shine mm-hmm. in a more beautiful way. And it's not, you don't have to discuss, like, mindfulness is not something out there. It's not something like special people have. It's something that is inherent in all beings. It just has to be uncovered, but you uncover it in the moment you're in. You don't uncover it in the future. You can't practice tomorrow.
Right.
So, you know, it's a very hopeful philosophy, and I'm a big believer in hope and inspiration. I want to inspire people. I want to create hopefulness in people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think this is a wonderful way to encourage people to reflect the greatness that they are in their own beautiful way, whether they're a garbage man or a politician or a policeman or a teacher or anything.
Yeah. Find your inner beauty, right? That there mm-hmm. is in everyone.
Yeah. You know, that's a worthy goal. And that's, you know, that's why I like doing this one-on-one work with people, because you can really go deep, and it's very satisfying to journey, to walk with people and to help them and help them grow. And to, I find it incredibly satisfying work.
Good. Well, listen, thank you so much for coming on today. It's been a great conversation. Where can people find you if they're interested in learning more about you and your courses? I'll include links as well, but just, you know, please promote your stuff.
Yeah, you can find me, you know, at my online home, davidfrankgomes.com. That's the best place to get in touch with me. And then, you know, I'm on the usual social media channels, and but that has all the information, and if people are curious, they can, you know, sign up for some time to talk. And I'm always happy to talk to people about what's going on in their lives and see if I can help them.
Great. It sounds good. Well, if you're listening and you're interested, reach out.
But it's been a delight. I find these kind of conversations very energizing. So thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Okay. Me too. They're great and they're powerful, I think. And I hope people listening, you know, have the same sort of feeling that we do. So yeah, thank you.
Me too.
We'll speak
Thanks,
soon.
Shane. Okay.
Take care.